So we now come to item 8 on the agenda, on your notice, on your order paper, and that's farewell to the First Church Estates Commissioner. I would be shortly inviting the Archbishop of York to give a farewell tribute to Sir Andreas. The presidents have invited Sir Andreas to make some brief farewell remarks to Synod after the Archbishop has spoken. And I will now invite the Archbishop of York to make his farewell tribute. And just before the Archbishop, sorry, Archbishop. No, it's not me. I apologize for that. There was a wrong instruction. Not me. It's not me. Yes. Okay. Archbishop of York.
This is for the second time of asking. And I hope there is no just impediment whatsoever. And Madam Chair, Sir Christopher Wren, John Wesley, Horatio Lord Nelson, Jane Austen, the Bronte sisters, Alfred Lord Tennyson, Theresa May, Sir Andreas Whittam Smith, as diverse a group of men and women as you could imagine, each in their time making a notable contribution to the life and character of this nation. And they have one thing in common. All spend their formative years as clergy children in Church of England parsonages. Andreas Whittam Smith grew up during the Second World War in a tough and much-bombed parish in Birkenhead, where his father was the incumbent. Canon Whittam Smith's churchmanship was, in Andreas's admirable description, on the equator, that is, in the very middle. Church life in Birkenhead seems to have had some of the characteristics of a grocer's shop where each member of the family had to do their bit. In Andreas's case, that meant ringing the bells, singing in the choir, putting out the hymn books, and here is the clue, counting the collection. After national service, spent in the ranks, Andreas went to Keble College, Oxford. As a Guardian columnist once wrote, being an Oxford graduate is like having a permanent source of emotional central heating. Whatever happens to you later in life, the fact that you were once at Oxford ranks you out as someone who was destined for greatness before accountancy beckoned. In Andreas's case, it was not accountancy but financial journalism that beckoned. By his own admission, he carried with him from Oxford two important lessons. One, after an excessively relaxed time there, was the value of sheer hard work. The other was that cleverness was not the same as intelligence and wisdom. This latter truth had been brought home to him when he tried to impress a tutor with a clever fact, only to receive the unforgettable put down. True, but trivial. Through hard work and exceptional ability, Andreas rose to become city editor, first of the Guardian, then of the Daily Telegraph, as well as editor of the Stock Exchange Gazette and Investors Chronicles. But for a restless risk taker like Andreas, these roles were not sufficient. In 1986, he became the founder and editor of what by then was the Rare List of Beasts, a new daily broadsheet newspaper. Within a few years, the Independent was outselling the Times, until the latter embarked on a price-cutting war. In 1987, Andreas won the Journalist of the Year award from the British Press Association, and 2 years later, the Granada Editor of the Year award, an unusual double. When he was editor of the Indy, Private Eye always used to refer to him as the saintly Andreas Whittam Strobes. I'm not sure about Strobes, but the relevance for our purposes is saintly. Let your light so shine before men. Andrea stepped down from full-time work in the newspaper industry in the 1990s and started to assemble an unlikely combination of new responsibilities. They ranged from the worthy, chair of the Financial Ombudsman Service, chair of the Sir Winston Churchill Archive Trust, to the lurid, president of the British Board of Film Classification, or, as had been known in less squeamish times, the British Board of Film Censorship. The worthy and the lurid, not a bad preparation for the life of the General Synod. It was in 2002 that Andreas accepted the Crown appointment of First Estates Commissioner. After their difficulties of the early 1990s, the commissioners had gradually rebuilt their strength under the determined and shrewd leadership of Sir Michael Coleman. But Sir Michael's successor had been able to serve for only 2 years. So when Andreas arrived, the jury was still out on whether the reforms of the 1990s would bear fruit. Those changes had included not only improved governance for the commissioners and a sharper focus on their asset management responsibilities, but the creation of the Archbishop's Council, of which the First Estates Commissioner was also a member. Andreas's early days were not without their dramas. An initial attempt at some radical thinking produced a memorable scene in the House of Bishops, worthy of a Batman cartoon, and the subsequent denunciation of Andreas's ideas in a synodical debate by the then Bishop of St. Albans as brutality with a smirk. But this proved a mere momentary setback, and Andreas quickly recovered. He did this because he understands the importance of listening and of trying to get to the heart of the matter. Partial knowledge is dangerous. Good decision requires insight, intelligence, and a determined focus on outcomes. It is crucial to work out the right thing to do and then think about how to deliver it rather than simply clutching at a politically convenient solution. Now that is the Andreas's philosophy. He likes to quote mischievously the provocative classification that the former chief of the German General Staff, General Kurt von Hammerstein Eckord, made of his officers and divided them into 4 groups, namely clever, diligent, stupid, and lazy. Some, he said, were clever and diligent. Their place were the general staff. The general, like Andreas, was also not too hard on those who were clever and lazy. Indeed, he saw them as qualified for the highest leadership duties because they presented and possessed the intellectual clarity and the composure necessary for difficult decisions. Then they were the stupid and lazy. According to the general, they made up 90% of every army, and they too had their places, so long as they were given only routine duties. The really disastrous combination was stupidity and diligence. Since such people would always cause mischief. Well, in Andreas, we have had for the past 15 years had the benefit of someone who's not only supremely clever and diligent, immensely knowledgeable of financial markets, and above all, robustly independent in his judgments. He has been loyal to the institutions he has served and to his colleagues, but he is no lover of conventional or convenient solutions. As chair of the Assets Committee, he has stoutly defended the responsibility of that body to reach judgments that will maximize the financial return to the church, subject always to the commissioner's ethical investment policies. He has also had the courage to strengthen the commissioner's professional expertise at staff level and to do what's necessary to secure people of the required quality. The results, as we have seen each year, have been outstanding, absolutely outstanding. When he arrived, the value of the commissioner's assets stood at £3.5 billion. 15 years on, they stand at somewhere between £7.5 and £8 billion. And that is after the commissioners have spent on the mission and ministry of the Church of England some £3 billion over the same period. The commissioners' exceptionally demanding target is to grow their fund over the long term by at least 5%, more than the increase in the retail prices index. Over the past 30 years, they have actually achieved RPI plus 6.3%. As Jesus reminded us in the parable of the talents, money is entrusted to us not as an end in itself, but for a purpose. Money is an asset for mission. As a commissioner and a member of the Archbishop's Council, he has been relentless in encouraging a sharper focus on church growth, building an evidence base and putting resources behind intentional diocesan plans. The disciplined yet far-seeing way in which he opened up the debate about whether the commissioners should make additional funding available for the renewal and reform program was indeed exemplary. The Synod has before it a report on lay leadership, and we have in Andreas someone who, through vision, clarity of thought and expression, has modeled for us outstanding servant leadership. When he has given the Synod one of his mastery interviews and overviews over the world financial scene, we have hung on his quietly spoken words. And when he has urged the Synod in response to a delaying amendment, to quote, he said, make a decision and stop fooling around. Indeed, we have heeded his advice. More than a decade ago, he wrote in his book, I shall never desert Anglicanism, even if I'm the last man standing on the bridge as the ship goes down. There's nothing that will drive me out. There are three things I might be prepared to die for. I'll die for my church. I'll die for my country. And I'll die for my family. Well, we all hope, Andreas, that it will never come to that. We also hope that you won't, as you threatened in that book, take to stacking supermarket shelves rather than stopping to work. No. Just keep writing. Enjoy music, praying, and being Andreas. And when you step down in June, it will be for us, as for you, the end of an era. We are deeply grateful to you, to Valerie, who has loaned you to us, and to Almighty God for all you have done. The Church of England owes you a great debt of gratitude. In the name of the Lord, we thank you. For all that has been, thanks. For all that shall be, yes.
Synod, I would now like to invite the outgoing First Church Estates Commissioner to make some farewell remarks to Synod. So, well, Andreas, you've got 10 minutes.
They never let you off, do they? No. I'm overwhelmed by what the Archbishop has said and by your presence and applause. It's simply fantastic, I think would be the right word. The Archbishop has always provided me with memorable occasions. I joined him for a day on his pilgrimage around his diocese. I think that was last year. And for a day we walked the highways from village to village. We even went to a traveller's camp, and we hadn't been there more than 5 minutes before the Archbishop had some of the travellers saying the Lord's Prayer. And I think that's a sort of fantastic example of sort of mission holiness on the ground. And These memories are, for me, unforgettable. I'd like to say a little bit about the Commissioner's funds, and then I'd like to say why I am extremely optimistic for the future of the Church of England. We've more or less got the results for 2016, which is that we will have, as the Archbishop mentioned, have grown our fund from just over 7 billion to just under 8 billion. We paid out 220 million to a whole wide variety of beneficiaries, including some old pension payments. And our growth was 16%. Those figures are not yet confirmed, but I think it will be 16%. The thing I'd want to say to my successor, whoever he or she should be, is to sort of work from the strength which this fund gives you. It's a perpetual endowment with only one client, the church. The perpetual endowment gives you time. You take very long views. You have the luxury of patience, which is denied to most investors, as a matter of fact. They have liabilities coming up quickly to meet. It's denied to pension funds and so on. But it's not denied to us. We do have patience. And having only one client, not having to meet a whole variety of demands, means that we can be single-minded. And I think I know what the church wants, which it wants us to be consistent. To me, the greatest defeat would ever have been to cut our distributions. That, to me, would have been a moment when I should push off and do something else. Consistency seems to me to be very, very important. We should produce real growth, which we've done, to pay for things such as reform and renewal. And we should bear in mind all the time the ethical considerations which the church wishes us to hold. And we don't take decisions without checking whether they fit with our ethical policies. We have a head of responsible investment who's in the office with us all the time. And so you only have to walk two desks along and you can ask advice. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? So these strengths all spring from being a perpetual endowment with one client. And that's what I'd want to say to my successor. Just work off that base. Now, I am very optimistic for the future of the church. I've mentioned on perhaps previous occasions to various groups the tests I have for successful institutions, whether they be commercial businesses, churches, national health hospitals, charities, schools, whatever. I think the tests are always the same. And the first one is whether you're capable of innovating. I think innovation is of the highest and greatest importance. And the very good thing is that the Church of England is ideally structured to innovate, because the widely dispersed authority, the fact that we are hundreds, perhaps thousands of individual units legally separate from each other, gives everybody a chance to do what they think is best and to experiment and take risks. If you're in a top-down organization, on the whole, you don't take risks because it's going to be bad for your career, probably. But the church isn't like that. So it is perfectly prepared to be good at innovation. And I think that the development of fresh expressions of church in the late 1970s was an act of spontaneous combustion. I don't think anybody told the church to do that. I think it just happened. I think enterprising clergy and lay people just got it going. And progress was slow, but it was steady. However, innovation alone isn't enough. other things have to come to the party. And the first thing that has to come to the party is funding. In 2002, the commissioners created a special Paris Mission Fund. Then in 2007, the commissioners and the council created the Spending Plans Task Group, which was brilliantly chaired by the Bishop of London. And since then, as you know, grants totaling millions of pounds have backed enterprising mission plans put forward by dioceses. Innovation plus funding, however, is not enough. Something else has to come to the party, and that's research. It's tempting to rely upon one's intuition and anecdotes, and they're pretty good, but they're not sufficient. So I think the moment when anecdote evidence was published in 2014 was very important. As far as I can tell, that was very influential in the way people thought about the future of the church and church growth. Still, we don't have all the elements in place. Innovation plus funding plus research. There's another one we have to bring to the party, which is training. People will know that I've always been very keen on training. I believe in 100% training. Everybody from top to bottom can be trained to do their work better. And it makes a huge difference. At the moment, there's very good training schemes underway for the leadership of the church. I think 75% of bishops and 40 deans have been on leadership programs, and I think this is terrific. And those I've met who've been on them have found them very helpful and useful. Finally, there's one more guest we need at this party. Innovation plus funding plus research plus training, and finally, facing up to reality across the church. And I think that, in essence, is what reform and renewal does. So I think we have a very full hand, and that's why I'm optimistic about the church. And so I say farewell, happy in the belief that the future looks good. Thank you.